Hello and welcome to the Cycling Science podcast, episode number 18, Atrial Fibrillation in Cyclists. I'm your host, Professor Richard Davison. For those of you who are new to this podcast, we aim to dive into the latest research on all aspects of cycling, usually by interviewing a non-expert or the author of a recent published paper. These interviews give us an opportunity to dig a bit deeper into the research itself, put the research into context, and end up with some practical takeaway messages. In this episode, I am interviewing an old friend who I studied with at university, Professor Jerry McCann. In his younger days, Jerry was a very accomplished runner, but I know that today he does also like to do a fair amount of cycling when he can. However, as a cardiologist with an interest in atrial fibrillation, I thought that he would be an ideal guest to interview to inform us on the relationship between cycling and atrial fibrillation, or AF as it's known. As like me, I'm sure you will know several cyclists who have developed AF. Anyway, I hope you enjoy our conversation. Right, welcome. In this episode of the Cycling Science podcast, I have the great pleasure of chatting to Professor Jerry McCann, who is a clinician and professor of cardiac imaging at the University of Leicester. Welcome, Jerry. Maybe you might want to just introduce yourself a little bit more than I have just given you your title.
So I suppose the first thing to say is Richard and I go back a long way, having completed our sports science undergraduate degrees in 19. At which point I was a aspiring middle distance runner, and I've stayed involved in sport since then, and currently dabble a little bit in triathlon. So I'm very interested in the podcast, and as a cardiologist, obviously, I'm very interested in heart health in relation to athletes.
Sorry, Jerry, I think in the recording there was a little blip in the internet, as you do get these days sometimes. So I will just reiterate that, we were together in 19, well, we graduated, wasn't it, 1989. Yeah, it seems a long time ago. And actually, I was reflecting about this because interesting the text you just used there, because I had written down a piece of text which said, looked nearly exactly the same as what you've just said. We go back a long way. but it seemed quite pioneering at the time, didn't it? You know, in those days, actually, there was a very limited specialist, like sports science textbooks, and limited sports applied sports science research.
No, absolutely. And I remember it being the first undergraduate degree offering sports science in the UK. So obviously, the amount of people I meet now, and whether it's athletics events or through work or whatever, and it's always, I did the first ever BSc in sports science. But I'm incredibly popular now, and you know, yourself and many others have really taken the field a lot further forward. Back in those early days, where I think it was fair to say, you know, you could have probably counted in a couple of hands the number of sports scientists actually in the UK at that time.
Yeah. And I think as well, you know, obviously our course relied an awful lot on pure physiology as well, which was a good, you know, it was a good grounding in many cases. But of course, sports science, as we know, is sort of much more broader than that. So you and I are kind of quite physiologically, medically based. We have to recognise the breadth of sports science these days. And as you mentioned, obviously, we are with the first group, certainly at Glasgow University, to get that new degree in physiology and sports science. And there was only 10 in our class. When you think of the size of, like, obviously, you know, the classes that we have currently at University of West of Scotland are, you know, 100 plus, you know, so it's and most universities have sports science degrees of a similar magnitude. So it's massive.
Yeah, no, it's interesting, and obviously, probably, 7 or 8 years after that, I taught in the first sports medicine degree in Glasgow as well, which didn't just take integrating medical students, but actually offered a BSc in sports medicine. And many of those graduates have gone into sport and exercise as a profession, or researchers, working in applied areas. And within our own research here at the University of Leicester, we've taken on a number of sports science graduates as well because of the impact and looking at interventions, both for prevention and treatment of long-term conditions, really.
Because I think the figures, and obviously they do go up all the time, but I think the last figure that I knew of in the UK at any single point in time, I think there's in the region of over 50,000 sports science students. I think it just gives you an idea of how much it has grown. Anyway, today obviously we're going to focus on the relationship between cycling and heart health. And we're going to particularly focus on obviously atrial fibrillation, which a lot of cyclists will be aware of. Maybe some of their friends or colleagues or more maybe famous cyclists who have developed atrial fibrillation. But anyway, we'll get to the atrial fibrillation. But I think just let's start at some of the basics. The relationship between exercise and your heart health. Just general exercise. So what does that look like? And I'm starting at the very basics up to maybe a Tour de France eventually.
Yeah, so I think the first and most important thing to say is exercise, regular exercise, and even moderate physical activity confers a huge number of benefits to your health. And probably of those, cardiovascular health is probably the most important. And if you look at things crudely, and this is going back to work way back in the 50s, even with just bus conductors versus bus drivers, there's a lower risk of death and cardiovascular complications in those who were more active at work. And, there's been thousands of epidemiological studies conveying that people who exercise live longer. And then there's been a huge number of studies, even looking at low level exercise interventions, looking at the mechanisms to really explain why that is. And if we think about it in as simple terms as possible, the major risk factors for heart disease are smoking, high blood pressure, high cholesterol, diabetes. And so I think there's an element of if you exercise, and certainly if you compete at sport, most people do not smoke, and that's probably the single biggest important thing. But even allowing for adjusting for risk factors, exercise gives you additive benefit. But if you take people and you introduce them to regular aerobic exercise training, then you get a lot of favorable effects, lowering of blood pressure, lowering of cholesterol by about 10% on average. You increase insulin sensitivity, which means you're less prone to developing type 2 diabetes. And then there really are other effects that are harder to describe, but an important part of your circulation is the ability to increase blood flow to your organs, muscles, etc. And that relies on the lining of the blood vessels, which produce hormones that open them up. And your vascular function is improved as well. So there are hormonal effects that directly influence these things. And then we can, they're the major impacts. There are other effects with regular exercise that probably reduce inflammation as well. Whereas if you do an acute bout of exercise, you get a sort of slight inflammatory response, but overall you kind of reduce it. And inflammation might be important when we deal with the actual acute events that occur with heart attacks and stroke, where atheroma or plaques, and the narrowings within the arteries actually rupture, and actually that's what causes a heart attack or stroke. So there is really widespread benefits. And that's just in terms of heart, that's before we even talk about improvement in fitness and the ability to undertake activities of daily living.
And what about the heart specifically, Jerry? So, you know, I think that's a really excellent sort of overview of, you know, metabolic and other physiological changes. But what about the heart itself? Because it's a slightly unusual. I think, you know, most normal people don't actually appreciate, I don't know, the complexity, the sheer beauty of the engineering, if you like, of the heart. And it is a muscle, albeit slightly different than the muscle that's in your leg.
And I was just about to say exactly that and trying to keep it relatively simple. You know, your heart has four chambers, but ultimately it's a muscular pump. And it's very, very similar to your skeletal muscles, whether that's in your thigh or your arms. It's just not under voluntary control. So the architecture of the heart in terms of its makeup is very, very similar. And we've known, you know, for at least 30, probably 40 years that if you undertake exercise training, aerobic or endurance sport, then the heart tends to get bigger. And that occurs on two ways. It actually increases and the volume increases slightly. And depending on the sport, there may be a slight increase in the wall thickness of the heart. And if you think about why that occurs, then probably the simplest way to think about it is for a 70 kilogram man, typically, you'll be pumping about 5 liters per minute, and your heart is doing that. And let's say, you know, your average heart rate's about 70 beats per minute. So it's about, your heart pumps about 70 milliliters of blood per heartbeat every minute of every day. But when you exercise, even at moderate levels, then people will be pumping about 15 liters per minute. So that's three times the volume of blood is being pumped around the body, returning through the veins into the right side of the heart, into the lungs, picking up the oxygen, coming back to the heart. So it leads to this volume overload, and your heart adapts to that to some extent by increasing in size. And because you then increase the heart in size, you can actually pump more blood per heartbeat. And when you're resting again, your demand for oxygen around the body is still met by your 5 liters per minute. So heart rate tends to decrease. And many of your listeners will know they'll have resting heart rates less than 60 beats per minute. Many will have less than 50, and some of them, maybe like me, will have resting heart rates less than 40 beats per minute. And like many of these things, there are genetic influences, and there's some early work going back, an army recruits looking at ACE genotyping, angiotensin converting enzyme, and there's more recent work now from UK Biobank, which is a big population-based study, showing that many different genes have small influences on on various aspects of your heart. So not everyone responds exactly the same way, that not everyone responds exactly the same way to training. But on average, the heart gets bigger and heart rate gets slower. And these are two of the cardinal features that we talk about in the kind of athlete's heart syndrome. And I mean, I'll just mention whether you want to lead into it or not. But, you know, clearly, if you look at Olympic athletes in different sports, they tend to have the biggest hearts.
And of course, the analogy to sort of, you know, your normal skeletal muscle on your legs or your arms there is the, you know, as you mentioned, the chamber size gets bigger, but the walls get thicker. And that's just, increase in muscle mass. You know, it's that muscle that allows you to pump, you know, harder, you know, because obviously there's the force required to pump a bigger chamber and more volume of blood is slightly higher. So it trains, it gets better at doing it, doesn't it?
Yeah, it becomes more efficient. I think that's fair to say. So you can pump the same or more amount of blood with less oxygen requirement for the actual heart itself. The heart muscle thickening is quite complex, actually, because most of the increase in mass is driven by the increase in volume rather than an increase in thickness. So if you're thinking about your bodybuilder type where the muscle is really up, it's actually more the volume. Some sports are definitely associated with an increase in the thickness more than others. And again, most of these data refer to ultrasound studies of the heart, which don't always give you great pictures. And though in athletes, they tend to, but rowing, for example, where you've probably got an isometric element, tend to have higher wall thicknesses. But of course, when you look at elite level rowers, especially if they're in the heavyweight categories, they're 6'5" and 14 stone. So it's not absolutely like for like. But the in most endurance sports, the increase in wall thickness is actually really very mild. And from a clinical point of view, we do worry a little bit when the heart muscle becomes thick. And there is data from general population, not so much athletes, because I'm going to reiterate, athletes live longer, even when you adjust for other heart cardiovascular risk factors. But there are data from population studies that bigger hearts are associated with increased risk of subsequent events down the line. And I wrote an editorial 25 years ago when we were doing some work in athletes, saying that, you know, we really need to understand this increase in increased thickening of the heart, increased size of the heart, because we were assuming it was beneficial, but we don't know that that was definitely the case. And as I say, there's a lot of variability in how much your heart increases in size.
And I suppose, like, you know, and this is digging straight into your area of expertise. You know, you mentioned obviously ultrasound, and there are other ways of measuring, you know, sort of the heart and so on. But not many, you know, the number of people that happens to is actually relatively small. You know, so the data, I suppose, we've got, I know, although it'll be growing rapidly as imaging becomes more widespread, it's, you know, particularly longitudinal, which would be the gold standard, wouldn't it? If you had longitudinal data, so follow somebody and follow their activity pattern and follow their heart dimensions, you know, and any complications, both physical and electrical, then that's the gold standard, isn't it?
The vast majority of studies are cross-sectional, so they take a group of people who exercise or don't exercise or exercise at different levels, and they compare them. The studies that have looked at interventions with exercise tend to be short. There are very few that have gone on over years, and part of that is expense, because then you've got to pay for the testing, etc. And then we've got large-scale epidemiological data, but they tend not to have the imaging investigations in them. So like on a population level, I mentioned again, like the UK Biobank study will start to shed some light in that, albeit it's only in middle age and older middle age adults, but 500,000 people have been recruited. 100,000 of those are planned to have MRI scans of both their brain and their heart. And the last time I looked, in fact, we've downloaded the data, but we've downloaded 45,000 of the MRI scans, and there must be over 50,000 recruited now. So there's a very large imaging enhancement study to that, and that really is shedding light on some of these questions. And there's also a submaximal bite test for a lot of the participants. And there's physical activity measures in that data set as well. So it's these massive resources that really will let us understand these things much better.
I suppose part of the problem is, you know, I know, you know, there can be lots of anecdotal stories about there's sometimes the newspaper headlines, such and such was a very good marathon runner and dropped dead at the end of the marathon, so with a heart attack. So obviously running's bad for you, or equivalent for cycling's bad for you. But that's not evidence.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And if I just digress a little bit, sudden death in sport gets lots of attention. And the commonest reasons for that is actually for someone to have heart muscle disorder at a young age, heart muscle disorder at an older age, it's narrowing in the heart arteries. But actually, so people used to get banned, and you'll know about famous footballers who have done it. But there's some recent data now showing that actually the risk in patients, even with heart disease or heart muscle disease, actually, if you test them and look after them, it's no greater during exercise than it would be at any other time. And of course, many other people thought that, doing endurance exercise was completely protective of heart disease, which is not the case. I mean, it clearly is helps in prevention, but it doesn't mean you're immune.
No, that's right. And I suppose that's one of the messages that we kind of take away is, that exercise is good for you, and regardless of your more nearly always regardless of your medical condition, in this case heart conditions, it's beneficial to do some exercise. And probably those people who do have sudden death may have died much earlier if they had not been active, and because their exercise has probably protected them for a period of time.
I mean, there's maybe one or two, very rare conditions where exercise may be bad for you, but they are exceptionally rare.
So I think we've had a good coverage just about sort of exercise in general, and some of the impacts on the heart, the heart getting bigger and allow you to have a, we call it obviously cardiac output, which is the multiple of heart rate and stroke volume, the amount per beat, which you need because you have to kind of match the demand from the muscle. But let's look a bit more. Cycling, do you have any perception of cycling as a sport? Is it any different? You mentioned rowing, with an isometric component, which could, enhance the wall thickness. But is there anything specific about cycling apart from a lot of cyclists do a lot of it?
Yeah, no, absolutely. So there is also some early data about perhaps cyclists have slightly thicker heart muscles as well, but they were Olympic cyclists, and I think a lot of them were sprinters. So there is that power element, and there's probably a little, compared to your endurance cyclists. And I've just been watching the Giro the last few weeks, and you look at how skinny their upper bodies are, and they really aren't doing much in the way, at least of upper body resistance, compared to your Chris Hoy's. So I think those real power athletes that cycle are very different to the endurance cyclists, because the forces in the blood, when you really contract the muscle at these massive powers, your blood pressure does go up. And if you're doing that repetitively, then you can start to see an impact, because as well as the volume overload from the aerobic exercise, then you get a little bit of pressure overload, which may cause the heart muscle to thicken. But I think that really is probably quite small. And for most people who go and maybe ride their bike for anything, 1 to 4 hours at the weekend sort of thing, and do that regularly, it's a much lower isometric load. Clearly, you're pushing the pedals, but not at huge wattages. So it's much more the volume overload that becomes the issue. And apart from that, I'm not really aware of a huge amount of data in terms of cyclists being different to endurance athlete runners in that regard.
I suppose the only difference, and we're just publishing a paper on this, is that Certainly at the very top end and many, many keen amateurs, is just the sheer volume. You know, you couldn't run the same volume because your body just wouldn't cope with it. So the sheer volume of training, you know, a professional cyclist, what does between 25 and 35,000 kilometers a year, you know, and you can start to do the sums how much time that takes them. Yeah. You know, I don't know any other athletes on the planet really, that are humans on the planet that actually expend that amount of energy.
Yeah, no, it's a very good point. So I've got a son who swims, and they're in the water about 20 hours a week. Mm-hmm. And if you obviously triathletes mm-hmm. are really doing it, and they might cycle, you know, half that amount, but then are spending another 10 to 15 hours swimming. And I think they do try to keep their running down. But you've got a few extreme, if you really are looking at the long distance triathlon, the Ironman type, their volumes are huge as well, really mm-hmm. huge. I do take that point. And of course, one of the real benefits of it, of cycling, is it's very kind on your joints. And I see so many elderly people still cycling and getting out at the weekends and doing long rides. And that's a real plus. And I'm just going to throw it in as an aside. I think as you age, you know, one of the key things with aging is actually stopping doing the things that you did when you were young, and actually maintaining your muscle mass is really critical to maintaining your independence and your exercise capacity. So that ability to maintain your quads, glutes, calves are really very, very important for independent living as you age. So I think there's no doubt it helps over and above the cardiovascular effects.
Yeah, because, you know, there is this concept of certainly I know that when we were students, you know, while there was limited data, there was maybe the suggestion, we knew that maybe a small amount of, going from no exercise to some exercise was always better. But there used to be this J-shaped curve that was presented, that if you did too much, it actually was bad for you, and it may even shorten your life. And, you know, there obviously was the mythical stories that you've only got so many beats in your heart, so if you use them all up, you'll die younger. But the data is really compelling, and the stuff that we've just analysed, you know, which we look specifically at yellow jersey wearers in the Tour de France. So they're likely to have done the highest volume, highest intensity of even a professional cyclist to reach that very, very high ability to have worn a yellow jersey. And you know, the increase in lifespan is quite remarkable. It's 20 years in comparison to the equivalent general population.
I think, you know, just coming on to some of the potential risks, you know, I alluded to this increase in heart size, and we're thinking it's been a good thing. As people have started doing more MRI studies and also CT studies, there's been some reports of a little bit of scarring in the heart muscle, release of enzymes from the heart muscle, particularly following endurance exercise, and then little bits of calcium, which is like chalkiness in the arteries. But these are all, you know, observational data, and you go, what do they mean? And of course, the other thing which we've talked about recently, and I think many of your listeners will know about, and the one thing that almost certainly does seem to occur more commonly, is an irregular heart rate called atrial fibrillation, which in itself isn't dangerous, but can predispose you to strokes. And there is, you know, emerging data across a number of responses to surveys and epidemiological data that people who really do extreme endurance sport seem to be at higher risk of this atrial fibrillation. And it's really what sparked my renewed interest in it, because I've got a number of people I know who have been good athletes, still exercising into their 40s, 50s, who've then developed atrial fibrillation. And whilst it's very common in the elderly, it's rare below the age of 60.
So great introduction to atrial fibrillation, because I think that is the one thing that many cyclists will be aware of, have heard of. But, you know, so what exactly is it? What is, you know, so the atria, the top chambers, the two top chambers of your heart. So what happens and you know, what's gone wrong?
Okay, so just in simple terms, obviously the ventricles are the main muscular pumping chumps, pumping chambers that do the bulk of the work. The atria sit on top of each ventricle and they act a bit like a reservoir. So as the blood is coming in, it allows the heart to pump, and then they hold the blood until the valves open, and then they top up right at the end of the heartbeat. They just give it an extra little top up. And your heart activity is regulated by an electrical system. And there is, everyone will know this, we've got our own pacemaker. And so there's it's called the sinus atrial node, SA node for short, and that sets off your electrical activity, and it coordinates the heartbeat in the top chambers. So they top up the blood before the heart, then the ventricles do their pumping. So it's nice and regular. The SA node sends us electrical activity anywhere between 60 and 90 beats per minute. And when you exercise, the hormones like adrenaline and your stress hormones, they have a direct effect to speed up your heart rate, so that when you exercise, you pump more blood. And as more blood comes in, that stimulates it as well. So what happens when atrial fibrillation is that nice regular electrical activity is lost, and the heart starts to, the top chambers start to fibrillate, and that means there's no coordinated electrical activity, and it's a bit like having a bag of worms. Everything, there is activity, it's just not coordinated, and it doesn't pump well. And people will know that if you get fibrillation in the ventricles, the main pumping chambers, ventricular fibrillation, that's causes sudden death. But in the top chambers, it doesn't do that. But it tends to mean you get more of the electrical activity going into the ventricles, and heart rate does tend to speed up quite variably. And so that can make you feel breathless. It can give you palpitation. If you're exercising, you'll almost certainly not be able to go as well. You'll see a drop off in performance. If you're wearing a sports watch or some of the newer bits, you might see a spike in your heart rate for a period. And if you don't see that gradual increase that you get, then it's a worry. So in itself, as I say, it's not really dangerous, but you might get symptomatic with it. But the real concern is, because the activity is no longer coordinated, blood doesn't flow smoothly, and it starts to circulate much slower. And there's a bit of the left atrium called the appendage, where the blood becomes very, very sluggish, and there's a tendency to clots forming in there. And that's what people worry about. And generally, the risk of clots forming, depending whether you've got other evidence of heart disease, if you get weakness of the heart muscle, if you're diabetic, increasing age, etc. And they generally, we see patients with atrial fibrillation, we can do things to keep your heart rate slow. You can try to restore the normal electrical activity, but generally it comes back, even if it's intermittent. It generally does come back. So the strategy is really to assess the patient's risk of stroke and against their bleeding risk. And if the risk of stroke is felt to be above a few percent per year, we would normally recommend blood thinning. And that dramatically reduces your risk of stroke back towards the normal population. But of course, especially if you cycle, you're probably not so keen on having blood thinners. because we all fall off our bike. And
at some point, it's nearly inevitable.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's definitely something to take into consideration.
Apart from obviously, you know, that suggested intervention of blood thinners to reduce your blood clot risk or stroke risk, in terms of managing those symptoms, you know, if you do develop it, what are the options in terms of a treatment? Because clearly, you know, most people, if they're going up a hill and they start to get AF, then you just, you know, you indicated performance goes down dramatically, and you probably have to stop which is not something most people want to do.
No, definitely. And so one of the key things is, in the early stages, often the atrial fibrillation really is paroxysmal, which means it comes and goes or it's intermittent. So you might be fine for weeks or months or even years. And in those cases, you may not need any specific treatment. If it's happening more frequently, then you may get offered treatment to reduce the risk of it happening. And the first line treatment for most people who develop atrial fibrillation actually is a beta blocker. And I think people will be aware of these. They're commonly used drugs for angina and also heart failure. And actually, they inhibit adrenaline within the body. So actually, they slow your heart rate down. And they have some effect on stabilizing the electrical activity of the heart, especially at higher doses. The downside of beta blocker tablets is that they can cause fatigue, although there are selective ones where that's not such an issue. And there are other drugs which can slow the heart rate down. So the challenge is if you do have an athlete who has atrial fibrillation, and if they've got a slow heart rate already, you're going to be less inclined to offer that specific treatment. And then there are a number of drugs which have specific stabilizing properties in the electrical stabilizing properties, some of which have got, you know, side effects, and we use those more cautiously and weigh up the risk balance. And there is interventions now in patients who are very symptomatic with intermittent symptoms, where you can do an electrical ablation, which involves putting tubes into the heart and then using either electrical to heat up areas or actually very cold cryoablation to create small scars in the pulmonary veins, which bring blood back to the left atrium. And the idea with that treatment is to isolate the atria from the electrical activity which may arise in the pulmonary veins. Now, I want to emphasize that that's an invasive procedure. It's been used in many. It does seem to improve the duration without atrial fibrillation, but it's not a cure. And most of the time comes back. But if you were very symptomatic, and particularly if your symptoms were not controlled by medicine, then that could be offered to you. And then I'm going to tell you the thing that no one wants to hear, and that is, you know, if you did develop this and you're doing your 10 or 15,000 kilometers a year, your cardiologist might say to you, well, exercise maybe is associated with this, and maybe you should cut back on how much you're doing. And that might be get done on a trial basis, at least.
Mm-hmm. I think, I suppose, the other side of that is, and you can correct me if I'm wrong here, but the reality is if you are diagnosed with AF, then, if you like, a competitive career is probably finished, because it's unlikely that none of the treatment, as you say, there's no cure as such. And most of the treatments impact on performance.
Yeah, so I think the situation is, if it is paroxysmal, you can, you know, you almost certainly can keep going, but there's going to be an element of luck as to if you're racing. And what we don't know is, are you more likely to go into atrial fibrillation when you are going flat out. When you do have more catechol drive, so the adrenaline is high and you're really at your maximum intensity, and you know we're in our 50s, but you know if your heart rate's up at 150, 160, is it more likely to happen then at another time? So I wouldn't say it's over, but you probably are going, okay, I'm getting into this competition and I hope I don't flip. And I know someone that was cycling up Tourmalet, and the last 4K average about 9.5%. And it was very much, if I get into EF now, that's it.
So, and of course, the typical age profile, but, you know, for initial, maybe the early signs, because it does tend to progress usually, doesn't it? Usually starts to get worse. Would I be right in saying that, you know, that the 50s would be, typically, there's not a huge number of people with AF under 50, is that right?
No, definitely. So, to be honest, under the age of 60, if we see someone under the age of 60 without heart disease, we investigate them to look for causes, because below that, it's really very uncommon. The younger you are, you know, and if you're developing it in your 20s and 30s, we'd investigate you top to tail, really, to look at causes. And there are other things that cause it, you know, that potentially are treatable. So an overactive thyroid gland, for example, would be one reversible cause, because that stimulates the heart as well and makes it more prone. But assuming that you don't have a reversible cause like that, then into the 50s, even, you know, I would still be saying, okay, that's on you, you're fit. I'm going to do an MRI scan actually to check there isn't a subtle underlying heart condition. And you may or may not get investigated for underlying coronary artery disease. Once you get above, you know, 65, it starts becoming quite common. And once you're above 85, it's very common. So the younger you are, the more we think, okay, what's going on?
Yeah. And of course, there is this, you know, if you look at some of the research studies out there, and the you know, I think one of the biggest ones is a study by Anderson, who looked at cross-country skiers, you know, a big sample, I think it's over 52,000, and looked at the relationship there between these very aerobically active individuals, and concluded that, you know, AF was more common in those, and potentially a dose response, which, you know, so there, that data does exist out there, although it's not, you know, we can say it's cross-sectional, and it's, you know, there are limitations to it.
So the best data for certain is from Sweden in cross-country skiers. And actually what they've done is they looked at one specific race, and they had about 200,000 people who've competed in that, and they compared it. And Sweden has got really good national records, so that are very well linked to outcomes. So they compared them to 500,000 people without. Now, I think the most important thing to say is actually, if you take all this, the cross-country skiers, which are a proper taxing endurance sport, you know, with similar, in fact, cross-country skiers have got some of the highest VO2 maxes recorded, in part because it's arms and legs, whole body. So it'd be very similar to, you know, your top cyclists, runners, swimmers type thing. So the most important thing to say is if you take the skiers overall, the risk of atrial fibrillation is lower than it is in the general population. So this is the thing again, actually. Now, if you control all the risk factors, it might not be so clear. But what they demonstrated is that the people who'd done the race the most and had the fastest finishing times, who you assumed had trained the most, had the higher risk. And that's where the data's most compelling. And I think it fits with what you're hearing, what I'm hearing. And when you do this and you start speaking to people, they go, oh yeah, so-and-so's developed that. And then I find someone else has had an ablation. And then you got going, oh, actually, this is common. much more common than you would expect. And really, that's what is alerted to us. And the real question about that is, okay, this does seem to be, and when we were talking about the heart size increasing, it's not just the ventricle that gets bigger. The atria, the top chambers where really you're talking about these fibrillating, they get big as well with this. And that then, we know this from heart patients, generally the bigger your atria, the more the risk of developing atrial fibrillation, and vice versa. When you develop atrial fibrillation, it actually causes your atria to enlarge.
So again, there are other studies out there, but yeah, again, you know, that one, the cross country skiers, you alluded to is one of the most compelling. So obviously I did look and see what there is in cycling, and there's actually very little on cycling. And there's really only one study, which is Woodward and colleagues. It's a Taipao bicycle study, and their finding was that the rate of atrial fibrillation didn't increase with the amount of cycling. So yeah, and again, they've got, it's okay. It's not a huge cohort in compared to the cross country skiing ones. So it's only 2,500. But so, you know, you just alluded to, and you know, we've discussed, you know, that there is, you know, this anecdotal, but we don't actually have an awful lot of evidence for the cyclists, you know. And I suppose there's lots of areas where we don't have evidence. And I know we chatted before, because the other area that there's data lacking is in the female athlete and the female cyclist, as is the case in many sort of sports science research studies. You know, the female element is there, but do you perceive that there's any difference for women?
So it's interesting because Susil Palakadathith, who worked with me on our atrial fibrillation study, had done a scoping review of females and the athlete's heart, and they are severely underrepresented. So I think what's clear across the board is we need more data on female athletes. And we were chatting about my recent cycling trip to Mallorca, and I hadn't been for a few years, and I really noticed a dramatic increase in middle-aged females in the cycling groups that were there. So, and I see, especially since lockdown, I think a lot more women have taken up cycling, and so that's a great thing. So we definitely need more data across the board. The Swedish study, interestingly, didn't show an increase in AF in the female skiers overall compared to the general, even at the higher levels. But again, the numbers might be on the low side.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So, you know, as far as we know at the moment, it does look like men are slightly more susceptible. But as you know, that's probably partly a limitation in our data set. So but anyway, thank you very much, Jerry. I think that's been a really sort of interesting conversation, and clearly there's lots more research to do, and I know you're actively engaged in that research. So could you allude to any work that you're just embarking on that might shed some light?
So what we're really interested in, and partly again from people we know, is I was quite concerned if we're seeing more endurance athletes with atrial fibrillation, and they generally have a healthy lifestyle. So they don't smoke, blood pressure is well controlled, they don't have diabetes, they've not got known heart disease. That if you look at them at face value using our standard scoring system, you would say they're at a low risk of having a stroke. And actually, the Swedish data suggested that whilst athletes with atrial fibrillation were at higher risk of a stroke than if you don't have atrial fibrillation, if you compare athletes with atrial fibrillation compared to the general population with atrial fibrillation, if you look at athletes with atrial fibrillation compared to those without, the actual risk of stroke was lower in the athletes. It was about 70% of that of someone without. So you think reassuringly that's at face value, that looks good, but actually there's very limited data. And we undertook a survey. It was promoted by GCN actually. And what we got was we got 1,000 respondents, and actually about 170 had had atrial fibrillation. So if you had atrial fibrillation, you were probably much, much more likely to come forward, because that's about 14% of the population overall. But what we looked at was how many had had a stroke, and really quite surprisingly, what we found was even if there was 14 strokes out of 170, and then but if you take those who would be classed as low risk, 12 of them had had a stroke. Now, your risk of stroke varies with time, but to me, that struck me as being quite high. And my concern with this is if your heart rate's lower and your heart's bigger and your top chamber's bigger, then if you go into atrial fibrillation, that blood really is going to start swirling. And that's one of the factors which predisposes to clots forming. So we don't know if they are at high risk or not, but it's just some data that says we really should find out. And so we are planning a study. It's going through the ethical approval process at the minute. Actually, we've got the meeting in a couple of weeks. But what we're going to do is take, and we're looking for the middle-aged athletes. So these are the ones where the decision about whether to have blood thinner or not is the more challenging. So we're going to take athletes who've got a history of atrial fibrillation, and we're going to take some athletes as controls who haven't. And we're going to do heart and brain MRIs. And what I'm interested in finding out is, do the athletes with atrial fibrillation have evidence of small, what we call subclinical strokes? So evidence of brain injury that may not have resulted in a symptomatic stroke compared to the others. And what we're going to do is look at the blood flow in the heart and the size of the chambers, and then link these to any brain abnormalities if we find them. And we'll get information, we'll start to tease out information. This is what we'd call a case control study, where we've got athletes with the condition, atrial fibrillation, athletes without, and then we'll start to look at the size and function of their heart. And is it the athletes who get bigger hearts that are more prone to the atrial fibrillation? And I know you've seen the video we did with GCN, where we had Simon Richardson, Mark Bowman, and they came up and we put them in the scanner. And Simon's heart was actually just borderline high. You know, you wouldn't really have batted an eye. And Mark's was a little bit bigger, but his top chamber was a little bit bigger than even his ventricle. So we'll start to tease out these things. And that's just the start, really. This is what we'd call a pilot study. We're very keen to do more epidemiological data looking in relation of physical activity to stroke. And we might try and use the UK Biobank data, particularly because we've got fitness data in a subgroup. It's about 50,000 with the participants. And if we can link that back to their MRI data as well, we'll start to be able to tease it out more than just the electronic records of people. So you'll have a bit of the detailed investigation, what we call the phenotyping, what the individual looks like inside.
Fantastic. And keep us abreast of that. I'm sure if we can help, we'll through our listeners, in terms of volunteers that might be interested in taking part. So let us know if you'll be looking.
If you have got people in that age range, sort of 40 to 65, who've had atrial fibrillation, we'll certainly be looking for volunteers and they can contact us. We're not quite ready. It's going to be at the end of the summer.
Yeah. Okay. Jerry, thank you very much for giving up your time. I know it's very precious, and it's brilliant just to have this chat, to chat through the stuff that interests both of us. Thank you very much for giving up the time.
Yeah, no, absolute pleasure. I've really enjoyed it, Richard.
Well, folks, I hope you enjoyed this episode. And of course, I need to thank Jerry for giving up his time. If you'd like to find out a little bit more, I have included some more details on the show website. And there's some references relating to atrial fibrillation. Of course, I also need to recognise my employers, the University of West of Scotland. And if you'd like to find out a bit more about courses we offer and the research we do, then please visit our website. That is uws.ac.uk. Remember, if you've got any questions that you'd like us to answer on a future show or topics you'd like us to cover, then please contact us through our website. That's cycling-science.com. Also, if you'd like professional advice or coaching from me, then please also use the contact page on our website or even through our Facebook page. Until next time, thanks for listening. And remember, good scientists and coaches always seek out quality evidence to back up their work. So never accept what you read or hear. Seek quality sources to inform your training and racing.